Andrea Conley here with Hudson Mohawk Magazine. In reference to ending the prohibition of the mind, a mushroom symposium, today I talked to Dennis M. Kitchen, who's a licensed mental health counselor in New York State. And I understand that your specialties are anxiety and panic and depression, life transition. That's a tough job, but welcome to Hudson Mohawk Magazine, Dennis.
What a pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
I understand that you started something that's an interesting concept. It's called The Lens.
Yeah, I wrote a paper when I was getting my degree in mental health counseling. The professor asked us to make up our own orientation after we'd studied about 13 different orientations like CBT, Jungian analysis, Gestalt, Rogerian Carl Rogers approach, all these different approaches. And he says, now make up your own. And I got struck with inspiration. I thought, oh, what if we took all the great things about psychotherapy, all the evidence-based approaches, and combined that with all the fellowship and family atmosphere of church, what would you get? So I wrote this paper called The Lens. You know, somebody could do that. Somebody could take the best of these both worlds. And by contrast, take out the worst of these two worlds, the worst parts of clinical treatment, the impersonality of it, part of the ethics of being a mental health counselor. You ought not to be anything but a mental health counselor to somebody else. And then what if we had all the superstition and idolatry associated with a church or religion and we got rid of that? I just kind of munched on that. As I was munching on that, I munched on some mushrooms for the very first time. My goodness, that was helpful. I'm glad I did that. I said, I got to get this into the idea of the lens. Grappling with the concept of how do you keep something as great as psychotherapy and as great as the mushroom experience, how do you keep this separated from the ceremonial and congregational and church life for all these years? Like, these need to get together at some point. Yeah.
You need to expand on that, because I'm not sure I understand what you mean.
Well, yeah, and let me just say, it's a work in progress, right? So whatever I say today that we're doing may not age well. We'll see how this goes. but for now, what we're doing is we meet every week, just like a church does on Sunday at 10 a.m., and we meet in a yoga studio, and we don't do mushrooms every week. We have retreats a couple times a year. This gives us several weeks before each retreat to sort of prepare people. So we'll have these workshops where people will meet formally and informally with myself and other members of The Lens. We just do an inventory of what's going on, all the constituent parts of what makes up your quality of life. And we call that the inventory. It was inspired by Françoise Borzat and her book, Consciousness Medicine. And then we also do some looking at Alan Watts and his admonitions and advice. And he was really big about making the connection that here in the West, our psychotherapy is an awful lot like Taoism and Hinduism and Buddhism. It's like our Western version of that is psychotherapy. We'd look at that for several weeks before the retreat. We practice meditation. You're gaining skill being able to focus your attention in certain ways. So all that preparation is taking place throughout the year. As far as my part in this, that's the only time I use psilocybin, either in preparation for our ceremonial use or during our ceremonial use. We will have like a rehearsal a few days ahead where anybody involved with the guidance and with the facilitating of the ceremony gets a chance to have their trip. And then we have the ceremony for other folks that come in, and we serve them, and we do so sober.
What are the, you know, psychological benefits of psilocybin?
If you look at the research that was done at Johns Hopkins University, NYU, and in other schools that are doing studies, what they found is that used in sufficient dose, so around 25 milligrams of psilocybin, it creates a mystical experience. You're going to hit this sweet spot of experience and state of mind where the default mode network parts of your brain become deactivated. You basically lose a lot of that ego, and you lose a lot of this autobiographical stream of content that's going through our minds telling us who the hell we think we are all the time. All that gets shut down, and now you're able to take on a more of the fire hose of consciousness coming at you. It's this moment that correlates also with what many over thousands of years have called a mystical experience or religious experience, grasping of the holy or the sacred. And of course, when you come back from that, you're more than welcome to choose whatever worldview you like. It doesn't necessarily change who you are in the long term, but it lets you get a perspective for a few hours that you otherwise might not have had on your existence and who you think you are. And many people that join us report this having had this mystical experience. That experience correlates with things like getting off of cocaine, getting off of nicotine, overcoming depression, especially depression that's resistant to other forms of treatment, changing your relationship with death. Let's just pause there. To me, that's the whole of psychotherapy. That merger between medicine and psychotherapy is changing people's relationship with death, which is where I consider the bulk of our anxiety to be coming from.
Symposium that will be on in April is discussing the idea of legalization, because right now this is a Schedule I controlled substance. Mm-hmm. And the United States government seems to believe that there's no accepted medical use and a high potential for abuse. How do you address the idea of legalization of this?
When I decided to start a church, I realized that, well, this is awfully convenient. It just so happens that churches and religion generally is the impetus for the entire First Amendment. It's the foundation of our Constitution. It's the foundation of the country. This could be an avenue of legalization, that is to say, using these tools, using these plants in a manner which is responsible, in which they were meant to be used, let's say. You know, crime is merely the misuse and abuse of tools. Like, we know guns, for example, aren't illegal. But using a gun in a manner which doesn't cause benefit, but instead harm, that's a crime. I have a feeling that's what happened with a lot of these plants and with these compounds and chemicals, is that people felt there was some sort of misuse of them going on. Maybe that's valid. And so laws were passed to address the misuse. I think if you establish a church and can say, look, we're really committed earnestly to using these tools and having this mystical experience, which is our birthright, we trump all of the local and state and federal laws that were erected against that. You know, our local assemblyman, Pat Burke, who's my district assemblyman here in New York, just put forth a bill to get psilocybin legal, to help in a clinical setting folks like first responders and vets. So there's a broad appeal across a lot of different political lines to see folks like that get the help they want to get, and that's great.
Can it be abused? It's a hallucinogenic. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Is that possible that if it became more readily available, it would be abused? The potential is there. Regulating the laws or its usage would either make it more appealing or destructive as far as psychotherapy goes?
Yeah, it's a great question. And I think we're going to find increasingly that just like we found with meditation and so many other things that have come along are usually touted as sort of like a panacea. We're already seeing that there's a dark side to the use of entheogens. It's another word that's the more ceremonial or religious term. Just as there's a dark side to religion and churches and cults and all of that, I think we're going to see increasingly people who have erred in that effort. There'll be abuses. People's defenses are dissolved. There's whole parts of our brains that sort of come online to help us, to protect us. That all gets relaxed. All those barriers get dissolved when you use psilocybin. And that kind of effect in forming relationships could be exploited. I think we'll see that happening. It's a huge danger to look out for. So that's why we talk about this kind of stuff a lot week to week. How do we prevent something like that happening to us as a group? So again, with an eye on evidence-based practices, with an eye on, well, okay, what are the constituent parts of a cult? What makes for people isolating and becoming more and more deranged in their relationships and in their thinking? And what causes abuse of power and control in people's lives? And then putting into place things that will just say, well, no, we can't cross that line. Here's the ethical boundary.
Is there something that you'd like to say in closing?
I guess I would say that there's a wide variety of folks out there across many stripes, and there's mainstream culture too that's getting more and more aware of psilocybin and aware of what's possible in therapy. Not everyone is going to be attracted to going to a clinic to receive this treatment. Not everybody's going to be interested in going to a fish concert or a rave or a festival to have this experience. For some folks, being in a sensible, reasonable, religious environment is exactly what the doctor ordered, so to speak. As we look at all these different proclivities and tendencies and settings, as the term is, for the use of this of these plants, I hope that we don't lose in all of the conversation the idea that there is this ages-old, ancient ceremonial tradition and way of being with one another, which may be one of the most effective ways to use this ever. And I hope that doesn't get lost in the excitement about the clinical application of it.